G.K. Chesterton wrote, "When people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in everything." Relativism rules. And religious relativism leads to social disintegration. This is the process we see outlined in Judges chapter 17 and 18. The process of social disintegration begins with religious relativism. When everything is true, nothing is true. The result is a secular society where morality is divorced from any religious foundation. You can't even talk about religion. And when morality is amputated from theology, we get anarchy. I began our study of Judges, and I said in the first service I couldn't remember the exact date. I didn't write it down here. And somebody pointed out to me that it was October 30th of last fall. So I began our study of Judges on October 30th, 2005, with this diagram adapted from Peter Kreft's book, How to Win the Culture War. It's the law of the four C's, which sociologists use to understand societies, cultures in general. We need to understand that people seek community. That is human nature. We need community. God made us to be communal people, to be social beings. And the only way to have a community, a society, live in liberty is to have each person governed by his or her own conscience. Ideally, that would be a perfect community. This conscience must have a common value system so that this conscience or value system keeps the community or society in order. This is liberty. And America was founded on this ideal that we could build a society with a common value system, a common conscience that would allow us to live in community in liberty. Well, when you slide into private consciences that have no common value system, then you slide into individualism and consumerism. Every person lives for himself and seeks his own happiness. This leads to chaos in any society, and no society can live long in chaos because we are made to live in community. So we can't live in chaos very long. Individualism, in turn, leads to sectarianism as groups within the society seek to define their own borders in order to establish a sense of community and safety for themselves within a society that has gone into chaos. So we all need community, so we increasingly evacuate the larger setting to control our own little worlds. And the church in America has increasingly evacuated the larger world around us to protect our own religious communities. And the result is always totalitarianism. When a society begins to disintegrate, it will always look to the increasing role of the C that is used here, cops, as a symbol for courts, legal coercion, political power, power of the state or power of the church, if you're in that kind of society, in order to control behavior. That eventually leads to totalitarianism in any society because cops are the only way to produce community without conscience. And we need community, so we will always slide eventually into totalitarianism. Germany is the classic textbook case in modern history of a country that went into chaos in the 1930s and so welcomed Adolf Hitler and totalitarianism to straighten out their chaotic environment. I take the time this morning to review all of that, because it is important as we come to the end of the book of Judges, our study of the book of Judges. And I said way back then that Judges is intended to be a biblical illustration of what happens to society as it slides down this slippery slope into chaos, into anarchy. And I hope we can see that the book of Judges illustrates that process. Israel as a nation is disintegrating. That's what's happening in the book of Judges. The author of Judges places these stories that we come to in chapter 17 and following to the end of the book, places these studies at the end of the book, even though these particular events probably took place earlier during the book of Judges. They are placed at the end of the book of Judges because the author of Judges, and many think that was Samuel, we don't know. The author of Judges, however, is not writing chronological history. The author of Judges is writing theology. This was a prophetic book. This was a book intended to make a theological point. And so he places these stories of social disintegration at the end of his book in order to make his point. Society is disintegrating. The only answer is more cops, more central authority. Twice in these two chapters, 17 and 18, and more times in remaining chapters here at the end of the book of Judges, we will see a phrase. And the phrase is this: there was no king in Israel. There was no king in Israel. That is the author's clue to his theological point. His theological point is, as society disintegrates, the problem is we don't have a central authority, we don't have a king. Every man does what is right in his own eyes. We need more cops to restore our sense of community. Now, there's a strong warning here to America. And I want to take a look at this process that we see in this Old Testament illustration of the nation of Israel and apply it to America, not because America is Israel, we are not, and not because we can make a direct correspondence, but there are principles here that help us understand our own culture and what is happening in our own nation. The first step down that road, then, as we walk through the process, as we get into the scriptures here this morning, the first step down that road is individualism. We all worship God in our own ways. That's the principle of individualism. Individualism says that the individual is more important than the community. The individual person should pursue her own fulfillment, whatever is good for her, and that she doesn't need the community to prosper. The individual family can establish their own personal worship, and no one can tell the family how to worship God. It is a private matter. That is the dictate of individualism. These important core values are private. They are our little domain. Chapter 17, verses 1 through 6. You thought we'd never get to the scriptures this morning. It's a lot here that I'm trying to pull together for us all this morning. Verse 1 of chapter 17, "Now there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, 'The 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. I took it.'" So here's one family in disintegration. "And his mother said, 'Blessed be my son by the Lord.' He then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, 'I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now therefore I will return them to you.' So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols, teraphim, and he consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes." Here we have the story of one family in the central hill country of Ephraim near Kiriath Jearim, pictured here. But we assume that this story is intended to illustrate the individualism of all the families of Israel. The grandmother reports that someone has stolen the family silver, and she places a curse on whoever has stolen the family silver. Her son then confesses to stealing the family silver. And her mother says, "Blessed be you, son, for confessing to me." And she blesses her son to counteract the curse, by the way, and devotes the money wholly to the Lord. And she uses the name Yahweh here. She's very specific. This is Jehovah. This is not just some foreign god. She intends to worship Jehovah. Well, all of this sounds good. We have a family in crisis. They correct the problem, their sin. They straighten that out, right? Except that she only gives about 20% of the Lord's of the money to the Lord, and she commissions the silversmith to melt the silver and to make it into an idol. A direct violation of God's law, the God she claims to worship as a family. The idol was probably a bull calf made of silver, such as the one pictured here that was unearthed in Israel. It was placed with the other idols, the teraphim, that's many idols, in the family worship center. They have their own shrine to worship God. Now, they probably thought that they were worshiping the one true God, Jehovah, because they use the term Yahweh, Jehovah, here. This is just our way of worshiping God. The idols were their private way of worshiping the one true God, rather than going where? All the way to the tabernacle in Shiloh. What did God say? He said, "I want my people to gather at the tabernacle in Shiloh to worship me." This is a community event. This is part of the unifying process we have as a nation, as a people of God. We gather together to worship. But instead, they don't do that. Each family would rather worship God in their own way and in their own time, and that is individualism. The family is oriented around their own private worship in their own home rather than following God's way of worship with the larger community of faith. The family was violating God's laws to follow their own family religion, a religion built around the family altar, not going to Shiloh to worship at the tabernacle. Individualism. The story continues. When a Levite from Bethlehem arrives in the family home in verses 7 through 13. Now, this is an unemployed priest, and he's looking for a job. God had set up how the Levites were to be taken care of. The Levites were to serve the people, and the people were to provide the Levitical cities to take care of the needs of the Levites. But it wasn't working. And so this Levite is unemployed, and this priest decides to freelance and find himself a place where he can make a living using his priestly skills. He arrives on the scene at Micah's home, and Micah offers him a job in the family worship center. He says to the Levite, whose name, by the way, is Jonathan, son of Gershom, we find that out later in the story. He says, "Jonathan, we will pay you 10 pieces of silver a year, and we will provide you a home, and we will provide you a new suit of clothes every year if you will be our priest here in this family." But now, the family in Israel would have been more than two parents and two children. It would have been the extended family here. But certainly, in our family, you will be our priest. The Levite, in turn, agrees, and in verse 13, as we end this chapter, we read, "Then Micah said, 'Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, He'll make me successful, seeing I have a Levite for a priest or as priest.'" He's my lucky rabbit's foot. It's awfully nice to have your own personal pastor as your protection. I remember living in a community years ago where there was a Roman Catholic priest, there was me, and there was another Protestant pastor from another denomination, I think. And one of my neighbors said, "Isn't this great? I'm covered. I got somebody from every group here, and that ought to make us pretty safe." See, the whole concept here that Micah had was, I've got my own faith, my own religion, now I've got my own priest. God's going to make me successful. And all of this is an example of consumerism. Religion exists to fulfill my desires. Consumerism. Go to the cereal aisle at your local supermarket, Hannaford, Shaw's. Look at the choices. Isn't it incredible what we have for choices for cereal, let alone everything else today? We pick and we choose according to our desires. Today I want my Cheerios, tomorrow I feel like cornflakes. And if that distinction is not enough, I can now have my pick of 8 different kinds of Cheerios. Whatever you want, we provide it. That's consumerism. And consumerism is killing the church in America today, to put it bluntly. I go to church as long as that church meets my needs. I put a few bucks in the offering plate to pay for the service, but I don't get involved much more than that. The pastor and the church exist to meet my needs, and if they don't, I make another choice. Today I want my Cheerios, tomorrow I might want cornflakes. Today I want this church, tomorrow I want a different one. Meanwhile, the pastor becomes a professional priest, someone who is paid to service the needs of others in this consumer world we live in. The pastor is paid to keep us happy and the offering plate's full. That's his job. He's a professional clergyman or clergywoman, as the case may be today. Am I being too harsh? Am I being cynical? I don't think so. I think that is reality in the church in America today. Let's look at the story and then apply it to both sides of this issue, because we are all at fault in this slide into consumerism. And it's all built around the principle that religion exists to make me happy, fulfill my desires. In chapter 18, then, as we pick up, a group of men from the tribe of Dan head out to look for a new place to live. The tribe of Dan is the tribe from which Samson was from. It is a tribe that had been pushed out of their land by the Philistines and the Amorites, is now living in various temporary camps, called each one of them called the Camp of Dan. In fact, Samson lived in one of the Camps of Dan. This slide, by the way, is in a place located near one of the ancient camps of Dan. Yad Heshmona is actually a messianic Jewish community in Israel today, made of Finnish believers in Christ, and they have this little commune that they serve and live in. The Danites, living in the camp of Dan, decide they need a safe place for their tribe to live, and in the process of looking, they come to the house of Micah. The men hear the priest, and they recognize his voice from a previous context, as you read chapter 18. They go in and they ask the priest what he is doing here. And he tells them that he's been hired by Micah to be the family of priest and to serve the family needs. And they decide that since someone else is paying the bill, they would ask him to give them guidance from God as to their quest. We are looking for a new home. And they explain their quest to him. He listens to them, to their request, and tells them to go ahead in peace. God will give them what they want. That's his message to them as their pastor. Now, this is wonderful consumer pastoring. He is telling them what they want to hear. After all, he is a hired pastor, and he is there to serve the people who need him and who pay the bills. And it doesn't take a pastor very long to figure out what that would be in any given situation. Give them what they want. And so he gives them what they want. The men of Dan continue on their way, bolstered by the Levites' message. Eventually, they arrive in the far north above the Sea of Galilee in the region of Lake Hula. It is a beautiful country that is spread out before them. Who wouldn't want to live in this country, in this land? And just think, God told us through the pastor that we would be prosperous. God will give us what we want. This is what we want, so what are we waiting for? The pastor told us. The land was beautiful. This is the headwaters of the Jordan River near the city that they established, the city of Dan. There were four different sources of the Jordan in this region. All four sources of the Jordan River are located in this well-watered plain. These sources provide plenty of water to supply their agricultural needs. Never mind that there are people already living here. They are living in peace. They are living in security. In fact, the Danites say, look, these people are so secure that they don't even protect themselves. They don't even have walled cities. We can take this land for ourselves. After all, God promised to make us happy, and this will make us happy. Now, there are two sides to this consumerism issue. First, let's look at the Levite. He was a professional priest, a pastor for hire to the highest bidder. He existed to serve their needs. And we see the same problem in the church today all too often. And by the way, I hope you've learned from our study of Judges that God is far more concerned with cleaning up His people than He is the society out there, because when He cleans up His people, then they begin to make a difference in the society around them. So God's very concerned about the people of Israel. And today, God is very concerned about His church, worldwide certainly, but here in America where we live. And we are a consumer society, and pastors become professional people. The pastor exists to meet the needs of the people who pay his bills. And any pastor can quickly learn what will make the people happy and fill the offering plates. Give the people what they want, because that is what a consumer professional does. And we're hired to make the customer happy. That is the sin of the pastor. And it is sin. For that is not God's calling. When a pastor becomes a customer service professional, he prostitutes his calling, as simply as we can put it. I recently finished reading John Piper's book, Brothers, We Are Not Professionals. John Piper is the pastor of Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minnesota, and he opens his book with these challenging words that convict my heart, because first I got to preach to myself. We pastors are being killed, he writes, by the professionalizing of the pastoral ministry. The mentality of the professional is not the mentality of the prophet. It is not the mentality of the slave of Christ. The more professional we long to be, the more spiritual death we will leave in our wake. For there is no professional childlikeness. There is no professional tenderheartedness. There is no professional panting after God, and God calls us to pant after Him. He's right. And throughout our culture, we are professionalizing to the point where the pastor is somebody for hire. And that is consumerism on the pastoral side. And it is sin. Professional pastors are one side of the consumer issue, but personal happiness is the other side, because that's what's driving it all. People want to be happy. That is our inalienable right, is it not? To be happy. That's to be fulfilled. Is that not our right, each and every one of us? Well, our culture certainly teaches that. Mortimer Adler, the rags-to-riches philosopher behind the American dream that created our consumer society, wrote years ago, "We ought to seek only that which is good for us." That's the American dream morality. Whatever's good for you, whatever fulfills you, whatever is your happiness, go for it. That's life in America. Each person seeking what is good for himself. But as Ravi Zacharias writes in his indictment of our consumer society, if my happiness is my right and the ultimate goal of life, why worry about anyone else's claims to happiness? And if the church exists to make us happy, who is to serve the needs of the people? If this is what life is about, this consumer-oriented world is a dead end. Rabbi Zacharias draws an analogy to the village man who visited the big city for the first time. He had never seen cars before, and he was overwhelmed with the speed at which the cars traveled. The village man thought to himself, "Wow, if I could only just move like that, life would be grand. Think what I could accomplish if I could move that fast from place to place. Think what I could get done in a day." As he stood by the road, he watched a car sputter and come to stop on the side of the road, and a man got out and walked away. When he came back, he had a can in his hand, and he opened up the side of the car and he poured the contents of the can into the car. Then he put the can down on the side of the road, got into the car, and he drove away. The village man ran up and he grabbed the can and he said to himself with a triumphant shout, "Now all I need is the thing that moves." And Rabbi Zacharias says, that's where our society is living. That's where secularism leads. We are consumers trying to fill our desires, never understanding what our real needs are. Eventually, our quest, because it's built into us in our human nature, leads to sectarianism. My rights trump your rights. Sectarianism seeks to restore a sense of community by controlling a part of the whole. That's what sectarianism does. We need community, so we will control a little part of it, a little part of the whole. Now, we see that in Iraq today, for example, as the various sects within Iraq work to control their little elements of the greater whole. That's what society falls into as we slide farther down this slope. Chapter 18, verses 11 to 26, the Danites return with a war party of 600 armed men. They are on their way to the territory in the north that they will take for themselves because the priest had told them that they had God's blessing. Along the way, they stop at the house where the Levite is serving the family of Micah. The Levite comes to the gate of the little village and he's talking with them. Meanwhile, they send a group of men to Micah's home and they steal the idols, the family shrine, and they come out to the gate. And the priest is standing there at the gate and he sees them stealing the idols and the family shrine, and he protests, he complains. "What do you think you're doing? You're taking the idols." And the 600 armed men standing around him say, "Shut up. Put your hand over your mouth. We got an offer for you. Which is better for you, to serve as the priest of this little family and get paid 10 pieces of silver a year, or come with us and be the priest of a whole tribe?" "Well, when you put it that way, glad to go with you." And he does. Why? Because he's a professional priest. He's got a better offer. It's consumerism played out. And he takes the better offer. He's glad to go along with the family idols, and he will go with this new tribe. He's got a job promotion. After all, he is for hire. Why not take a better deal when it's offered? The Levite leaves with the men of Dan. He stays with them, even though, as the story plays out, Micah, his former employer, comes running to the top of the hill and says, "What are you guys doing? You're stealing my gods and my priest." And the armed men said, "Yeah, we'll do more than that if you don't go back to your home." And so Micah leaves. I wonder if he ever stopped to consider the irrationality of his complaint. If someone can steal your gods, what good are your gods? And the author of Judges is certainly prone to use sarcasm to make his point. Religion becomes a tool to achieve an end. When we want something, it becomes easy to remake religion to suit our desires. All we have to do is find a sect or a group that will let us have what we want, even if it is at the expense of others. My rights trump your rights. My happiness is more important than your possessions. Morality has nothing to do with it because morality is a private thing. And we're going to make our own community. A few years back, the trial of the century focused on football great O.J. Simpson. You remember all of the stories, the headlines that ran week after week in that whole episode. Accused of murdering his wife, Nicole Brown Simpson. O.J. Simpson eventually was acquitted in the criminal trial that was just laced with racial and ethnic tensions and all of this sectarianism going on as people were riled up over this whole event. Robert Shapiro, O.J.'s lawyer, later was interviewed by Larry King after the trial was over. Larry King asked him what he personally thought about O.J. Simpson's guilt or innocence. What innocence? Was he guilty or was he innocent? This was his defense lawyer. Robert Shapiro replied, "It does not matter what I think. What I believe is something that really is of no importance, and I will tell you why. That's a moral judgment. And I can't make moral judgments. I can make only professional judgments." Hello? Doesn't he realize that his professional judgment is, in fact, a moral judgment? Individualism leads to privatization, and this is the result of privatization. It is a disconnect between my moral values or my values, which are private and never affect my professional judgment, or so I think. And that's our society, built on privatization today. You are not supposed to take what you think over here because you're supposed to be professional over here, but in fact, everything you decide and do professionally is, in fact, filled with moral consequences in the decisions that you make. Right, the Levite in our passage made a professional judgment too, but it has moral consequences. And in our world today, we have so disconnected our public and professional lives from morality that we don't even realize that we are making moral judgments every time we make professional judgments. And sectarianism teaches us that my rights are more important than your rights. Sectarian divides, it fragments a society so that we can have control of a sect or a part of society. But when society fragments into all of these sects, we have all of these little parts, and what is going to happen? Those parts are going to start fighting with each other. And we're seeing it all around us, where little sects start fighting with each other in our society. And ultimately, that's going to lead to one result. Peter Kreft and other sociologists or social philosophers say, ultimately, it leads to totalitarianism. Might makes right. Control by central authority. It's only a matter now of who has the most power. Whoever wins gets to declare themselves right. The family of Nicole Brown Simpson surely doesn't share Robert Shapiro's perspective, but he won, so he gets to say he's right, I guess. Eventually, all social and religious relativism leads to totalitarianism. And that's Peter Kreft's point in his analysis of our society. America is sliding into totalitarianism, as strange as that sounds to our ears. We hear the word totalitarianism, and we think, America? No way! But history is all against us. History says that the more chaotic your world becomes, eventually, and as little groups fight with each other in that environment, eventually, people will gravitate toward totalitarianism to control all of that behavior. Might makes right, to restore control in a society gone to chaos. Now, there are two kinds of totalitarianism, social philosophers tell us. First, there is hard totalitarianism, which we are going to see in this passage in just a minute. That is coercion by military might, actual killing and violence. But there is also soft totalitarianism. Soft totalitarianism coerces people to live by the standards of those who are in power, by words and by the legal system and by the media and by all of the influences. There can be a soft totalitarianism that takes place. The media and the state force compliance to certain values. And that surely is happening in America. In Massachusetts this week, for example, you probably read that the Catholic Charities got out of the adoption business rather than be forced to give children to gay parents. The state said, you will give children to gay parents or you will not function. And Catholic Charities said, it's violation of our conviction, so they opt out of. And this is happening time and time again as people opt out of the system because they are being coerced to violate their own convictions within the system. And that's soft totalitarianism. All right, the Warriors of Dan lead the way. 27. Chapter 18, verse 27. Then they took what Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to them, to him, and he came to Laish, to a people, quiet and secure, and struck them with the edge of the sword, and they burned the city with fire. Well, this is hard totalitarianism. They attack a city living peacefully, and they destroy everyone in it. They burn the city with fire in the name of God. And incidentally, the church historically has gone to totalitarianism as well as a way of coercing what the church wants. And that is just as wrong. If the church is over the state, we always end up in trouble. If the state is over the church, we end up in trouble too. For God decreed two institutions, and they need to function independently. They burn the city in the name of God. They kill everyone. They build a whole new city and they name it Dan. Archaeologists have uncovered the mud brick gate from the time when Dan was first built over the ruins of the people of Laish. And they're continuing to excavate this city today. The people of Dan set up the idol. They install the priest as their high priest of success. Just look what God has done for us, they exult. Coercion, hard totalitarianism. In the name of God, not God's way. The area becomes a hotbed of idolatry down through the years. Many years later, King Jeroboam will come to this city. He will continue the idolatrous practices with the golden calf that he sets up in this city. Archaeologists have uncovered the high place of Dan and the location of the idol that the Israelites worshipped in this place. Might makes right, but it's not God's right. Morality based on our rights leads ultimately to tyranny and disaster. Morality based on God's law leads to liberty and safety. The well-known social critic Dennis Prager was debating the Oxford atheist Jonathan Glover a few years ago, and he raised this question to him in the context of the debate. He said to the atheist philosopher Jonathan Glover, he said, "If you were stranded on a street in Los Angeles, a back alley in Los Angeles at midnight, and you got out of your car and saw 10 big men coming out of a doorway toward you in the darkness, would it make any difference to you to know that they just came from a Bible study?" Well, the audience laughed. Even the atheistic philosopher had to laugh, because of course it would make him feel much better if those men had just come from a Bible study as opposed to a gang meeting where might makes right. See, morality based on God's laws makes an enormous difference compared to morality based on might makes right. And we all know it, even the atheist, in practical terms. So religious relativism leads to social disintegration in the nation of Israel and in any society ultimately. Okay, what are we to do with this knowledge? I got 2 minutes. Well, Ravi Zacharias writes, "The soul of a nation is changed one person at a time." You see, when the church gets involved in the public coercion process, we're simply stooping to the means of our environment. It's not God's way. That's not how God changed the Roman Republic. He changed it one person at a time. That's God's way. And Ravi Zacharias tells the story of Sammy, a good friend who lived in war-torn Beirut. Here was a city and a society in total anarchy. Beirut at one time had been a beautiful city, a prosperous and wealthy city. It was totally torn about by sectarian violence. And Sammy, a Christian, lived right in the middle of that chaos. And in Beirut at that time, might made right, and everyone did that which was right in his own eyes, just like the book of Judges. Sammy and his wife were driving along a highway when he saw a large suitcase lying on the side of the highway. Now, most would have driven past, and Sammy's wife begged him, "Please, to drive past. Don't pick it up. Leave it alone." But Sammy could not do that. He stopped, he picked up the suitcase, he put it in the car, and they drove on home. They opened the suitcase at home and found it packed with money. It was filled with money. There was also an address and a phone number, so he called the owner and eventually got a hold of the owner. The owner turned out to be a man fleeing from Beirut. He had taken all of his money out of the banks, he'd put it in the suitcase, and he was running to catch the last boat out of Beirut in this war-torn city, and he dropped the suitcase. He'd lost the suitcase filled with all his money. So they made arrangements to meet, and when the man came to Sammy's home, Ravi Zacharias happened to be visiting in the home that day. And he said they met, they talked, and he handed him his suitcase. And then Sammy gently said to him, "You think you have recovered your treasure. Let me tell you how passing a treasure this really is. With the fragile state of our country, this could become completely worthless overnight. Let me give you the greatest and the most enduring treasure you can ever have." He reached over and he picked up his own Bible off the table and he handed it to the man as he left. Read it. The city of Beirut was in literal ruins, chaos from the social anarchy that had taken over that city. But the city of God was still intact. Sammy was doing what Christians can always do in times of chaos: point people one by one by one to the city of God through the Word of God, for that is the greatest treasure anybody can have. And that's God's call on our lives today. Father, teach us. Teach us to first live as you want us to live, and then make a difference one by one with the people around us. Not to pull out, not to evacuate, but to stand firm and share your treasure with those who need it most. In Jesus' name, amen.